Genesis 29, and we read from verse 1 to 30. Then Jacob continued on his journey and came to the land of the eastern peoples. There he saw a well in the open country with three flocks of sheep lying near it, because the flocks were watered from that well. The stone over the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone away from the well's mouth and water the sheep. Then they would return the stone to its place over the mouth of the well. Jacob asked the shepherds, "My brothers, where are you from?" "We're from Haran," they replied. He said to them, "Do you know Laban, Nahor's grandson?" "Yes, we know him," they answered. Then Jacob asked them, "Is he well?" "Yes, he is," they said. "And here comes his daughter Rachel with the sheep." "Look," he said, "the sun is still high. It is not time for the flocks to be gathered. Water the sheep and take them back to the pasture." "We can't," they replied, "until all the flocks are gathered and the stone has been rolled away from the mouth of the well. Then we will water the sheep." While he was still talking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherd. When Jacob saw Rachel, daughter of his uncle Laban, and Laban's sheep, he went over and rolled the stone away from the mouth of the well and watered his uncle's sheep. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and began to weep aloud. He told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and a son of Rebekah. So she ran and told her father. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister's son, he hurried to meet him. He embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his home. And there Jacob told him all these things. Then Laban said to him, "You are my own flesh and blood." After Jacob had stayed with him for a whole month, Laban said to him, "Just because you are a relative of mine, should you work for me for nothing? Tell me what your wages should be." Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder one was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, "I'll work for you 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel." Laban said, "It's better that I give her to you than to some other man. Stay with me." So Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, but they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her. Then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife. My time is completed, and I want to make love to her." So Laban brought together all the people of the place and gave a feast. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to Jacob, and Jacob made love to her. And Laban gave his servant Zilpah to his daughter as her attendant. When morning came, there was Leah. So Jacob said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me?" Laban replied, "It is not our custom here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the elder one. Finish this daughter's bridal week, then we will give you the younger one also, in return for another 7 years of work." And Jacob did so. He finished the week with Leah, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. Laban gave his servant Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her attendant. Jacob made love to Rachel also, and his love for Rachel was greater than his love for Leah. And he worked for Laban another 7 years. Wow. How do you make sense of what happens in your life? When all is fine, we tend not to think that much about it. We enjoy the success, we enjoy the pleasures of life. When things are going well, we don't really think that much about it. But when trouble comes, then we start to ask questions. Why has this happened to me? What's going on? Is there any purpose in it? Some people will try and shrug off the difficulties and troubles of life. And they'll say things like, "Well, that's just life, isn't it?" Or, you know, "You've got to take the rough with the smooth." Others put it down to fate. "That's just what was going to happen to me. I've got to accept it." Some think it's some kind of bad karma, or that it's punishment that's come your way because of something you did in the past. Well, God in the Bible teaches something very different to those ways of thinking. God is active in this world which he created. And God is at work in all of our lives. For people who do not yet know God, God's great desire and purpose is that they would find him. If you turn to Acts chapter 17, and here the Apostle Paul is speaking to the Athenians, and he tells them this in Acts 17 and verse 26. From one man, God made all nations that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. And so Paul is saying that God is in control of the nations, of all the details of people's lives. And then he gives the reason, verse 27 of Acts 17. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. That's God's purpose for the world, for each individual. God wants people to seek him, to reach out and find him. And all the history of the nations is with that great purpose in mind. Those who have come to know God, those who have found God, well, God has this purpose, that he will conform them to the image of his Son, in the words of Romans 8:29. If someone has become a Christian, has been reconciled to God through his Son Jesus, then God's purpose for them is not that they stay as they are, but that they be changed, that they become more and more like Jesus. So whether you are a Christian or not a Christian, there is purpose in all that happens to you. Far from being meaningless, both the good times and the bad times are when God is doing something in your life. And this is what we see here in the life of Jacob. This is how we're to understand this rather shocking event in his life. And so we're going to see how, for a time, everything is going well for him. But then, of course, suddenly it changes dramatically. And we're going to try and make sense of what is going on here and then see what it can teach us. So, first of all, we're going to see how God is at work when life goes well. That's our first heading. God is at work when life goes well. The chapter begins with an unusual phrase. It's not really translated fully for us in the English versions. But the literal statement is, Jacob picked up his feet. Now, that's not an English expression, and so we just read, Jacob continued on his journey. But it kind of implies that Jacob is moving on with a spring in his step. Remember, he left his parents' home. His parents urged him to flee because his brother Esau wanted to kill him. Jacob had deceived his father Isaac and stolen the blessing. As the firstborn son, Esau was the one entitled to that blessing, but Jacob had tricked his father, and Esau was enraged. And so Esau wanted to kill Jacob. Jacob had left in a hurry, fleeing for his life. He was alone. As he says later, he had nothing but his staff with him. But then God appeared to him. And God appeared in a dream, and we saw this last week. There was this stairway from heaven, going from earth to heaven, with the angels ascending and descending on that stairway. And God spoke to Jacob. God didn't rebuke him for his bad behavior, but God made wonderful promises to him, promise upon promise. And we saw how gracious God had been to him. And actually, Jacob responded very well to God's grace there. He didn't say, "Oh, I can't accept this. I've been too bad." No, he accepted God's grace. He worshipped God and he vowed to serve God, that the Lord would be his God. And so, with his father's blessing and with God's promise of protection, Jacob has a spring in his step. He travels on confidently. And he arrives at a well in the open country, in the land of the eastern peoples. And he finds three flocks of sheep there and some shepherds waiting by this well. And so he starts to talk with these shepherds, asks where they're from. Well, turns out they're from Haran, the very place he's looking for. Of course, there weren't signposts in those days, so his journey has been successful. And then he asks them, do you know Laban, the grandson of Nahor? And they do know him, and he's well. And just then, in the distance, Rachel appears with Laban's sheep. Well, Jacob can't believe his success. And perhaps buoyed by this success in finding the right place, well, he speaks up rather brashly to these shepherds. I don't think he's picked up on the shortness of their replies. Did you notice in verses 4 to 6 that the shepherds give not quite monosyllabic answers, but very brief answers? And Jacob doesn't seem to pick up on that. Perhaps they see him as a bit of a cocky young man with this spring in his step. And then he kind of adds even more. He says in verse 7, look, the sun is still high. It is not time for the flocks to be gathered. Water the sheep and take them back to pasture. And he's basically telling these shepherds how to do their job. Well, that's the confidence that Jacob has. But then, as his cousin Rachel approaches, Jacob's talk turns to action. And we wonder, as you read the story, has he already fallen in love with her? Or is he wanting to impress his uncle Laban? Either way, Jacob shows great strength by removing that massive stone from the mouth of the well. Earlier on, it had said this was a large stone and how more than one shepherd was needed to remove it. And this, I presume, is why the different shepherds gathered at the same time so they could help each other remove this stone. But here's Jacob, and he impressively shows his great strength by removing that stone. How amazed Rachel must have been, not just at his strength, because then he goes on to water all her flocks. What's going on? Who is this guy? Well, when he's finished, he greets Rachel with a kiss and he weeps out loud. And then he tells her who he is. He's the son of Rebekah, her aunt. Well, Jacob has made quite an entrance. You know, if you're out to impress someone, guys, this is the sort of thing you need to do. And Rachel obviously is impressed. She runs and tells her father Laban, and Laban welcomes Jacob in. You are my flesh and blood, he says. Quite an entrance. No doubt Laban is reminded of that time some years earlier when Abraham's servant had arrived, had also come to a well, we don't know if it was the same well, and had come looking for a wife for Abraham's son Isaac. But there's one big difference. Whereas Abraham's servant had come with 10 camels and huge amounts of wealth, gold and jewelry and costly gifts, Jacob has no camels. He has no wealth with him. And Jacob is the one who waters the animals. Back in chapter 24, it was Rebekah who gave water to all the camels. So things are rather different on this occasion. Unless a month passes, Jacob continues to help with the flocks, and it becomes clear that he has by now, if not at the very beginning, fallen in love with Rachel. Look at verse 16. Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder one was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes. Possibly means she didn't really have much sparkle in her eyes. Perhaps more depressed, we don't know. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Jacob was in love with Rachel. Now, I suspect that Laban, the father, noticed. You know, when you're a father of daughters, you kind of do notice how other guys look at your daughters. So he would have noticed what was going on here. And he hatches a cunning plan. Verse 15. Laban said to him, "Just because you are a relative of mine, should you work for me for nothing? Tell me what your wages should be." Jacob, of course, has no wealth to give a kind of marriage, costly marriage present, like Abraham's servant had done for Rebekah back in chapter 24. But Laban knows that Jacob is in love, and he expects that Jacob will want to serve him for his daughter Rachel. She's beautiful, he wants to marry her, and he knows that he would have his parents' approval. After all, they had sent Jacob all this way saying, "You need to marry one of Laban's daughters." Well, there are two daughters, and it's quite obvious to Jacob which one he wants, Rachel the younger. And so Jacob makes what is actually a very generous offer. Verse 18, "I'll work for you 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel." Laban has got more than he could have wished for. Wow, 7 years labor. That's a huge amount of work. This is an extremely generous offer. Actually, Laban ought not to have accepted that much. Though in fact, as we'll see, he's going to demand another 7 years, far more. Notice in Laban's reply, he does not mention Rachel's name. Verse 19, Laban said, "It is better that I give her to you than to some other man. Stay here with me." Has Laban already hatched a plan in his mind? Does he already plan to give his older daughter, Leah, to Jacob? Well, Jacob suspects nothing. He works hard for 7 years, but we're told they seem but a few days because of his love for her. He's happy. He's in love. He's going to marry the most wonderful woman he's ever met. She'll come with her father's approval. She is the most beautiful woman. He's happy. Life was good. His troubles are over. Soon he can go home with his new bride and take on the family business. He'll inherit his father's property and animals. Life is good. God is blessing Jacob. Hadn't God said that he was going to be with him and would bring him back to the promised land? And that is true. God was blessing Jacob. But God has some more plans. Plans to improve Jacob's character. God was at work in Jacob's life when things were going well here. But things will turn a corner. So let's think now how God is at work when things go wrong. Our second heading. God is at work when things go wrong. So Jacob had worked 7 years. Jacob had been faithful. He and Rachel had stayed faithful to each other, but now the time has come and he asks for his wife. Verse 21, then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife. My time is completed. I want to make love to her." So Laban organizes a wedding, a week of festivities. He invites neighbors, puts on a feast, and in the evening, when it's dark, he brings his daughter to Jacob. Of course, in the dark, Jacob can't see clearly who it is. Maybe he's had a bit of wine and perhaps, you know, a little bit inebriated. But of course, he assumes that the woman he sleeps with is Rachel. Can you imagine his horror in the morning when he wakes up? I mean, it's just unbelievable, isn't it? He's horrified to find that it's Leah next to him. He is deeply hurt. He's been tricked. He's been deceived by his very own uncle. And you can just picture him marching off with his complaint. Verse 25. When morning came, there was Leah. So Jacob said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me?" But Laban is too clever for Jacob and leaves him with precious little choice. Verse 26, Laban replied, "It is not our custom to give the younger daughter in marriage before the elder one. Finish this daughter's bridal week, then we will give you the younger one also, in return for another 7 years of work." Well, at the end of the week, Laban gives Rachel to Jacob in exchange for yet more work. Jacob can't go home. He's got to wait. And even worse, his marriage to Rachel is now going to be spoiled for life, because there's hint already here at an intense rivalry between his two wives. Verse 30, Jacob made love to Rachel also, and his love for Rachel was greater than his love for Leah. Polygamy is never commended in the Bible. The pattern for marriage is given to us in Genesis chapter 2. God gave Adam one wife, not two or more. And so polygamy, though it was permitted in Old Testament times, was never commended. And worse, if the two wives were sisters. There's this intense rivalry between Rachel and Leah, and Jacob's life will be unhappy as a result. What was Laban thinking? Did he really care for his daughters? It seems Laban is just after free labor, after money. What is Jacob to make of it all? Hadn't God promised to watch over him and to bring him back to the promised land? There's no comment in the narrative as to how we're to understand these events. Occasionally, when you have stories told in the Old Testament, there'll be a comment, like the thing that King David did displeased the Lord. But there's no comment here. But what we do have is the narrative really pointing out clear parallels between what happened in chapter 27 and what happens here. Chapter 27, Jacob was the one who deceived his father and his brother Esau. And there are these parallels. In both chapter 27 and chapter 29, there is shocking deception by a relative on a relative who is tricked out of their rights. In both, the deception depended on darkness. In the case of Isaac, it was the darkness of his blindness. Here, it was the darkness of the evening. In both, there was that sudden moment of truth when they realized that they had been grievously tricked. And in both, the issue was over whether it would be the older or younger sibling who would get priority. Notice what Laban says in verse 26. "It is not our custom here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the elder one." And of course that was the issue between Jacob and Esau. The elder should get the blessing, not the younger. Although in fact it was God's plan for the younger to get the blessing. And so these obvious parallels between these two gross deceptions. Wrong as Laban had been, Jacob cannot have failed to see the similarity of what happens to him with what he had done to his brother and father. This time, Jacob is on the receiving end. He is the one who feels the pain, the hurt, and the anger. And over the next 7 years, as Jacob has to work for his wife Rachel, he has plenty of time to reflect on what has happened to him. And every time the rivalry between his wives flares up, he is reminded of how he was deceived by his father-in-law Laban. But he can also remember how he himself had hurt his brother and deceived his father and behaved badly. And though this won't be the last time Jacob is deceived, never again do we read of Jacob deceiving others. Oh yes, he'll need to behave wisely with his father-in-law Laban. But never again does Jacob do something like he had done before. He'd kind of tricked his brother out of the birthright, and then he deceived his father to get the blessing that was to go to Esau. But through these painful events, Jacob is changed. You know, I suspect we all lack full insight into how our words and our behavior sometimes hurt other people. Jacob can see something of how his actions had upset Esau. After all, Esau wanted to kill him. But he doesn't really see how bad it was until he was on the receiving end. And sometimes we don't really see until it hits us like this. James 3 in verse 2 tells us, anyone who is never at fault in what they say is perfect, able to keep their whole body in check. But we're not perfect. Our words do hurt people, and sometimes we don't realize. And sometimes it's only when we're on the receiving end that we start to see what we ourselves are like. I don't know about you, but when I'm driving my car, I often will notice how badly other people drive. But you know what? I've found over the years that the thing I need to do is start counting and see how long it is until I do the very same thing that I've criticized in someone else. Cutting a corner, going over the speed limit, whatever it might be. We're very quick to see faults in others, and especially when it hurts us. But our wisdom is to think, are we like that? You see, God, who'd shown such grace to Jacob at Bethel, giving him promise upon promise, is also the God who wants to change Jacob. Jacob had trusted in God and declared that the Lord would be his God. And like with Abraham, anyone who believes in God, who has faith in God, that faith is counted as righteousness. All who believe are the children of Abraham. All who put their faith in God are justified. Abraham's faith was counted to him as righteousness. Jacob has been justified. He's accepted by faith the promises that God has made. He's received God's grace. Jacob has been justified. His faith counted as righteousness. But when God forgives and accepts someone, that is just the beginning. God's grace in saving us is not so that we can carry on in our old ways, but God is committed to sanctifying us, to making us holy. So how are we to make sense of things that go wrong in our lives, especially the disappointments and the hurts that we feel? If you haven't realized it already, you'll discover that you cannot control everything that happens to you. But this does not mean that you are simply at the mercy of others, or that everything is down to chance, or fate, or bad karma, as we said earlier. There is a God in heaven who is in full control of every single person's life. Behind this universe is a personal, loving Creator, God who cares about you. And he ordains the events of your life with this purpose, that you should reach out and find him. And so he has given his own son, Jesus Christ, to bring you back to God. And though God allows pain and hurt in our lives, that pain and hurt will never be more than he allowed Jesus to go through. Jesus, who was rejected by his own people, by the people he had taught and helped. Jesus, who was forsaken by his own friends, the disciples, betrayed by Judas, denied by Peter. Jesus experienced that pain and that hurt, and then the sufferings on the cross as he took our sin and our guilt. He paid for our sin with his own life. And graciously, he offers us forgiveness and a new start. And he wants you to accept that. Just like Jacob accepted the promises that God made, he wants you to reach out and find him and know that he is your God. And when you do so, he will start to change you. Like a fruit tree being pruned, God will make you fruitful. Like a child who is disciplined, God will lovingly correct and train you. His greatest concern for you is not your success, your career, or even your health. His greatest concern is that you become like his son, Jesus Christ. And so it says in that famous verse, Romans 8:28, in all things, God works for the good of those who love him. Actually, the verse starts with, and we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him. We know this. We have this confidence that as we go through life, everything that happens to us, God is at work in it and through it. And so you have a choice. Will you trust that God is working for your good, even in the pain and the disappointments and the difficulties? So don't be bitter. Don't be consumed by anger when you get hurt. But learn. Find God and trust God. Let's pray.